If the ice hadn't retreated about 10,000 years ago, we probably wouldn't be here right now, at least not with all the trappings that interglacial civilization has brought us. So the question many folk ask is, when's the next ice age due? And as we're pumping carbon into the atmosphere that took millions of years for nature to sequester, what might trigger a collapse of the ice sheets we still have in Greenland and Antarctica? I don't know if my next guests can answer those questions, but they have been studying records of deep sea temperatures and their link, if any, with the amount of ice about. They are Dr. Gavin Foster from Southampton University's Department of Ocean and Earth Science and Elko Rowling, Professor of Ocean and Climate Change at the Australian National University. They are both on the line from the UK now. Hello to you both.
Hello.
Hello.
How much, first question, I don't know who's going to answer this, but either you can have a crack. How much has the Earth's climate warmed and cooled over the past 5 million years? In other words, how many ice ages and interglacial periods have we had as far as we can tell?
Well, I guess the first thing to point out is that we're on a sort of global cooling trend that's obviously being reversed now with our anthropogenic activities. But over the last 5 million years, on average, we've had this sort of global, slow global cooling, and sort of interrupting that slow change has been these, like, as you pointed out, these glacial interglacial cycles where we've switched from warm climate to cold climates with ice, warm climates without ice, cold climates with ice. So it's been, you know, it's this gradual trend, probably 3 or 4 degrees warmer globally than today, back during the warmest period about 4 million years ago. And then we've sort of those cold climates have sort of, I guess the coldest of those cold climates was only 20,000 years ago, where the Earth is probably about 4 degrees cooler. So we've had about 8 degrees sort of swings, really, I suppose, from the warmest to the coldest.
How many times has it got really cold?
That's a tricky question. If I had the right sort of graph in front of me, I could spend the next 20 minutes counting them. But it's every a sort of regular beat every 40,000 years, we've got a colder climate. There's a 40,000 year cycle going from cold to warm.
And how far are we through the current one? I mean, I said 10,000 years ago, the glaciers retreated. That's what I remember. I'm going off my memory of geography stage one, however. Was I more or less right with that?
Well, if you're talking about when we are going back into a glacial, there's a lot of discussion about that, because the primary forcer of the glacial cycles is the orbital configuration of the Earth and Sun system. And according to the orbital theory, it's not clear when we should be going into another glacial, because the orbital forcing at the moment is very weak. But the orbital forcing is only one part of it. And the other part is the feedback processes, where greenhouse gases are a very, very important player for starting a glacial. So certainly with our current greenhouse trends, there's not much of a chance that we will soon slip into another ice age.
The orbital forcing theory. Now, can you explain that a bit better? The idea is that where we are in relation to the sun, our orbit affects our climate.
Well, yeah, that's right. I mean, the way that the Earth is tilted towards or away from the sun, how circular the ellipse of our orbit is, and the sort of wobble of the Earth's axis as it rotates. These are the three main causes of climate cycles during all of Earth's history, really. And they're caused by gravitational interactions between the Earth and the other planets that sort of just slightly disturb the Earth's orbital configuration. And that changes the distribution of heat and solar radiation, really, to the Earth's surface. It doesn't really have much of a big difference on mean annual temperature, but it just determines where summer, how hot it's going to be in the summer, or how cool it's going to be in the summer, and how long the summers are. And that has a really big impact on the survivability of ice So when the Earth's in a orbital configuration that favors cold summers, that means that the ice that forms during the winter just doesn't melt, and that leads to a buildup of ice, which trips the system into an ice age.
Is that because it's not a perfect circle, it's an ellipse, our orbit around the sun? So if the pole, if our axis is, well, the axis is pointing towards the sun, when the Earth is closer to the sun in that ellipse, then the summer will be stronger?
Partly, but most of the so that's what you're talking about there really is the eccentricity of the orbit, which goes from being virtually a pure circle to being an ellipse. And we're sort of have an elliptical orbit now, but at times in the past it's more circular. But the main issue is the tilt, like you pointed out there, that the Earth's axis tilts towards or further away from the sun, and that has a big impact, particularly in the northern hemisphere, on the duration of the summer and the amount of insulation that hits the Earth during the summer.
It's about the tilt of the axis is about 22 degrees, isn't it?
Yeah, 23 and a half.
Right. Has it always been pretty much that?
No. So it oscillates on a 41,000-year cycle between 23 and a half and about 22, which doesn't sound like very much, but it's enough to trigger, well, about 10 degrees cooling in the high latitudes during summer.
The more it's tilted towards the sun, the stronger the summers are, and the more ice that melts?
Yeah.
Why? That's right. It's a dumb question, but why? Well, actually, it's not such a dumb question, really. Why does the axis wobble a bit?
Well, that's like I say, it's because of the other planets.
Right.
Are interacting with the Earth as it orbits around the sun. So actually, because of that, it's all sort of Newtonian physics, and we can do a pretty good job of predicting 40 million years ago what the orbit was doing, and predicting 40 million years in the future what the orbit's going to be doing, because it's regular like clockwork.
And is that why we can be pretty confident about when we should get a cooler period? Is the orbit tilting pretty? Does it run pretty close to the glaciations?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, as Ilkka said, if it wasn't for the greenhouse gas forcing, we'd be potentially facing a sort of ice age in the next 10,000 years or so, or the beginnings of one. What I should say is that over the last 900,000 years, the oscillations of the cold and warm periods have changed their period. So over the last 900,000 years, they've changed from being this regular 41,000 year to being 100,000 years. And then the 100,000 years is a very slow build-up over 90,000 years of cooling, and then a very rapid warming. So, yeah, the next ice age probably would have begun about in 10,000 years' time, but it would be a very slow build-up to something like we had at the last glacial maximum, if that makes sense.
But the orbit and the tilt of the axis on their own don't explain, what is it, 8-degree difference in average temperature between the warmest period in the last 5 million years and the coldest period. That's 8 degrees can't be explained by what's happening in our orbit and axis, can it?
No, that's right. And it's because those orbital cycles are regular, they have no long-term pattern to them. So the cooling over the last 5 million years is driven by something else. And the favoured explanation, although, you know, we don't necessarily have a smoking gun for this yet, but the favoured explanation is that atmospheric CO2 has declined over the last five million years. That's led to a gradual cooling. And then CO2 also plays a role within each glacial cycle, so that the orbit controls the distribution of insulation. The amount of sunlight hitting the northern hemisphere causes ice to grow. Then the ice interrupts patterns of ocean circulation that cause the oceans to take up more CO2 from the atmosphere. And that whole thing causes a sort of cascade that the Earth system then suddenly trips into this sort of glacial climate. So CO2 has an important role to play in the long-term cooling and in each forming the cooling in each cycle.
Nights on Radio New Zealand National, speaking to Dr. Gavin Foster from Southampton University and Professor Alco Rowling from the Australian National University, talking about glacial periods. Now, the thing that you've been looking at is the record, the history of deep sea temperatures. What's the link between that and glacial periods?
the link between deep sea temperature and glacial periods is in general that both of them have been temperatures been going down and ice volumes have been gradually going up. And previous to our study, we really didn't have a way to separate those two effects from each other, because the only other continuous record that we have over more than about 1.5 million years is based on a technique that actually compounds deep sea temperature and as an approximation of global temperature, and it compounds that with ice volume or sea level, if you like. And so as a result, we didn't really know how the two were behaving relative to each other, but with this work now we have a first good indication that although temperature is going down whilst the ice volumes are generally increasing over time, we are in a situation now that it looks that they are not going down in synchrony. There are differences in the steps through time in the cooling and the ice volume buildup, which was a bit of a surprise.
In other words, just because there's not a direct link between temperature and the amount of ice, you can't simply say, well, if the average temperature on the globe is such and such, we can expect this amount of ice on Greenland and over Antarctica and over Europe and Asia. It's not as clear as that. There's something else going on.
Yeah, there are other things going on. And I mean, as a very good example, of course, if it were to get very, very cold, it would get very, very dry and you wouldn't build up any ice. So you have all sorts of feedbacks there where to build up ice, you need to have conditions that are conducive to having a lot of precipitation, a lot of snowfall on the high latitudes. So there you can already see that the link is not easy. It's not always an intuitive link. And in addition, deep sea temperature can only go so far down. It can only go down to about -1, -2 degrees, whilst the atmospheric temperature could go down to -30 or -40. And so the deep sea temperature has a, if you like, has a bottom to it, and you can't push it colder than that.
How have you been trying to get an idea as to what deep sea temperatures were like millions of years ago? How do you do that?
So there are two ways of doing that. One was employed in 2012 by a colleague from Cambridge. And he uses a method that measures the ratio between magnesium and calcium in unicellular microfossils from sediment cores. And that technique goes down to about 1.5 million years ago. And then by using the deep sea oxygen isotope ratios, that is the measurement that I mentioned before that compounds deep sea temperature and ice volume. He takes out the temperature component and finds ice volume. We have now turned it around. We have made a new method that actually measures the sea level change, so the ice volume. And as a result, we can then look at the deep sea oxygen isotope records to take out the sea level component and find the deep sea temperature. So it's a completely different method than what our colleague from Cambridge uses. But over the last 1.5 million years, it gives more or less the same results. So we're very confident that we're both on the right track. And then our method allows us to take the thing back to 5.3 million years ago.
Now, if you're looking at oxygen isotopes, you can go back, you can get a longer, deeper record of temperature. But how do you get this stuff, these isotopes from water that was around millions of years ago? Where's the stuff stored?
That's a good question. It's stored in microfossils, and we can get sediment drill cores from the open ocean, and then you measure on deep sea floor living microfossils.
Fossils of tiny organisms.
Yep, tiny organisms, about the size of a grain of sand.
And if you look at the oxygen isotopes in those, they will tell you how warm or cold the water was. What is it about an oxygen isotope that gives away the temperature in which this microorganism was living millions of years ago?
No, the oxygen isotopes give you a combination of the deep sea temperature and the global ice volume. So it's that combination that you then need to disentangle with another method.
Okay. And once you've done your research. And whereabouts were you, by the way, finding the microorganisms, the fossilized microorganisms?
Yeah, so our record that we use is being measured in the Mediterranean Sea, because the sea level method that we use focuses on water exchange through the Strait of Gibraltar.
And when what? Because at times if the sea level is low enough, does water not go through the strait?
Well, if you were to drop sea level 280 meters, then that would stop water going in and out of the Strait of Gibraltar. But it's a very narrow and shallow pinch point. It's 284 meters deep. And so as a result, you have this very evaporative sea sitting behind a strait that is very restrictive for its communication with the open ocean. As soon as you lower sea level, that communication with the open ocean goes down, reduces, and as a result, the ice-type ratios in the Mediterranean are very sensitive to the amount of that change in the exchange through the Strait of Gibraltar. And that you can capture through a hydraulic control model for the Strait of Gibraltar, and you can couple that to calculations for how the isotopes would change in the Mediterranean Sea. And
okay. So the isotopes provide you with a bit of a record as well as to the level of sea. You can be reasonably confident with those isotopes to predict how high or low the water level was at that point. Then you have other isotopes, which, by the way, when you're talking about deep sea temperatures, how deep is the ocean that you're talking about?
Well, the ocean has an average depth of about 3.7 kilometers worldwide. So a lot of these deep sea cores, most of the deep sea records that have been put together are for more than 2 kilometers depth.
And these are from fossils of organisms that you can be confident lived at those depths?
Yeah, they're bottom dwellers, and you know these microfossils they don't migrate around very much, so they're living where you find them.
What do you find in terms of what happens with deep sea temperature and sea level, which I'm guessing is obviously how you then work out how much ice is around?
Okay. So you mean what do we find with how the deep sea temperature changes So we find that sea level, the major hypothesis was that around about 2.7 million years ago, there's an intensification in the Northern Hemisphere glaciation. So this is when Northern Hemisphere started to glaciate. And what we find was that rather than that being a big sea level story, we find that it's the deep ocean that mainly cooled at that point, giving the impression that there was a big change in the ice volume. I mean, there are indicators on land that you can see that the oldest sort of glacial deposits are around about that age, 2.7 million years ago, and we start to see sediments that have been delivered to the North Atlantic by icebergs also start to appear at 2.7, but generally, what we find in our new record is that sea level change at that point isn't that large. There is a change, but it's not as big as the changes that happen subsequently in the record.
In other words, the temperature, are you saying that the atmospheric temperature had fallen?
That's a difficult link, as Ilko said. The link between the deep sea temperature and the atmosphere is not straightforward. And, you know, there is this bottom, because you can't freeze, you know, the deep water hasn't frozen, it can't be colder than minus two. So you have that, the atmosphere could be minus 30, but the deep water is only minus two. And it kind of depends on the temperature of the air where the deep water formed. So if you have a change in ocean circulation, then that can also induce deep ocean cooling, because you're forming the deep water somewhere else. So, you know, the link to atmospheric CO2 is difficult without, I mean, the link to the atmosphere is difficult without a record.
What is the link then between deep ocean temperature and glaciation, if any?
Well, there isn't a direct link necessarily. You can glaciate. You might even be able to glaciate. And in fact, there's a studies out recently looking at glaciation in Antarctica 34 million years ago that actually you can glaciate and not cool the deep ocean. You could even warm the deep ocean when you glaciate. Our link is because of the way in which we've determined the deep sea temperature and we've determined the sea level. It's through this the oxygen isotopes of these microfossils. And the oxygen isotopes in those microfossils depends on both the temperature of the water they grew in and the amount of ice on land. So there's our, you know, our link is almost mechanical, mechanistic or technique based. There is no necessarily sort of a causative link between the two.
How does that help us predict what might happen with ice sheets in the future?
Well, that's a very good question. I mean, the first thing, of course, is that we are looking on very different timescales, right? So each sample that we are looking at has got a spacing to the next sample of 1,000 years. So that would be like you have a measurement point in medieval times, and now you start to look at a measurement point today, and then you start to draw an inference of that for the future. So that would be a little bit tricky to take these things that are natural phenomena, because there were no anthropogenic forcing at all in those times, and also spaced, the observations are spaced very widely. So we're looking at how the long-term climatic system actually functions. Now, how that helps us is because by understanding how the system and all its feedbacks work better, we can start to improve the way that we can represent these long-term responses in models, and that sets us up for looking better at the long-term responses in the climate system. And then the long-term response is part of that is the trajectory from today towards the full long-term response to a change in the climate forcing. And that sort of long-term pathway is, you know, it takes build up, and as you may have seen, that ice is beginning to respond around the planet, is beginning to reduce. We now have things like the Thwaites Glacier reducing quickly, the Pine Island Glacier reducing quickly, both in West Antarctica, and then we have mass loss over Greenland. And these may be, and we think they are, responses of the world gradually to the fast change in climate forcing that we are doing with CO2. So it's basically focusing on a better understanding of the Earth system rather than just immediately extrapolating into a number for the future.
If I put it crudely, am I right in saying that temperature in the end, atmospheric temperature and ocean temperature, is a measure of the amount of energy within the global system? The global climate system. And so when we look at climate change, it's not just a question of what happens with the air temperature, it's also a question of what happens with the temperature of our oceans. And how important is deep sea temperature in understanding what happens with the energy, the extra energy that might be stuck in our atmosphere now because it's not escaping, because there's more carbon dioxide up there, for example.
Yeah, that's a very good question. And what people have to remember is that, you know, the ocean, a 10-meter layer of ocean contains as much energy as the entire atmosphere. And so we have a situation where we have good observations of ocean temperature change over the upper couple of hundred meters. But the ocean, as I said, is on average 3,700 meters deep. And it is fully connected, but the deep sea responds very slowly. So we see that already, you know, with this so-called global warming pause, is that part of that is explainable because an enormous amount of heat over the last decade has gone into the equatorial Pacific Ocean, and there's good measurements of that. And that sort of warming of the ocean is obviously not warming the atmosphere, so the atmospheric temperatures are then beginning to lag around a little bit. It's not that we are not warming the planet, it's just we are warming for a while, we are warming another part of the planet.
When you look at historic records or evidence through microfossils of changes in deep sea temperature, What's the range? How much has our deep ocean changed in temperature over the period you've been looking? 5 million-odd years?
Yeah, it's changed something like 4 degrees. It's not, so that's yeah, it's about four degrees for the duration of the 5 million-year record that we're looking at.
Which might not seem like much, but after what Alco just said, which is that, you know, given that the top 10 meters of the ocean can hold as much energy as, what was it, did you say the atmosphere? Most of the atmosphere? Well, then if you add on all the rest of the ocean, that's actually a huge amount of energy, isn't it?
Exactly.
That's right. Yeah.
So the ocean has been helping us by taking up a lot of the heat that went in with a signal that spread out over the hundreds of meters or thousands of meters of the ocean is almost imperceptible. So it's only from very careful measurements campaigns that we are now getting an impression of the heat that has gone into the upper 700 meters or so. And increasingly now in the areas where there's deep water formation, like the North Atlantic, there's people recording warming that is extending much deeper down. So there's a lot of the heat is going into the deep ocean. The downside of that is that as the deep ocean is warmed, the heat will be in the ocean and therefore in the climate system for a very long time, because it takes equally long for that heat to come out. So we could stop our emissions, we could cool the planet, whatever way, and then the ocean starts to give back the heat because it seeks a new equilibrium with the cooler atmosphere.
You mentioned that pause that is, which is you're referring there to the fact that if we look at average global temperatures since the end of the last century, late 90s, they more or less plateaued. They were rising quite relatively quickly, and then they plateaued. They haven't gone down, but they haven't gone up. This is air temperature, and the idea is that, well, that's because more energy is going into the ocean. But why would it be? What triggers a warming of the oceans? If the atmosphere was getting warmed and now more of that energy is going into our waters, why did that change?
Well, so first of all, the plateau you mentioned is there is quite a lot of discussion for that, because a lot of that plateau is also caused, at least half of it is caused by the fact that Arctic measurements around the North Pole were not very well integrated. It's very hard, of course, to make measurements in a closed grid there, so you need to integrate that into the mean signal. And that was done in a very crude manner, and we knew from the occasional observation stations in the Arctic region that actually Arctic warming was very strong. So there's been recently work where this is better integrated and added into the global warming, and actually that pause is just a slower warming. It is not a plateau. It's just a period of slower warming. Then there's another component why it is slower, and that is the heat that has gone into the Pacific. And that is, you may be very aware there in New Zealand, we certainly are in Australia, about the El Niño Southern Oscillation. That's a big climate, it's a big coupled ocean atmosphere system that oscillates. And there are similar cycles like the Pacific Decadal Oscillation, the North Atlantic Oscillation, etc. There's all these oscillations that in the ocean atmosphere system, which are basically about where energy goes for a while and then it comes out and it starts to go somewhere else. It's a turbulent system.
When you look back at those records of deep sea temperatures, and I know you said that it's difficult to see, we're still trying to work out the link with ice cover and sea level, but from what you've seen so far, is there a link? If when deep sea temperatures begin to rise in the records, is that followed by a drop off in the amount of sea and the amount of ice, so that sea level rises as well?
Yeah. So whereas it's quite difficult to turn deep sea temperature into a number for global temperature change, certainly when the deep sea warms, the ice retreats, and that's a pattern that we see throughout the 5 million-year period that we're looking at.
How quickly or slowly does this all move?
would it's governed by the slow scale forcing. So this is all orbital scale. So, you know, imagine the planets circulating the sun. It's all very slow, and it's sort of a deglaciation. Probably takes about 5-6,000 years to fully retreat the ice. So actually, maybe a bit longer to fully retreat the ice. But most of the change is done in that sort of time period.
If warm, I mean, that's another basic question. But if deep ocean water temperatures rise and that affects currents, how long does that take for, say, a conveyor of warmer ocean, deep ocean water to move and impact, say, away from the equators towards the poles?
Well, that kind of depends on which current, I'd imagine. I mean, certainly the ocean warming has been implicated in the retreat of the marine-based West Antarctic ice sheets that we're hearing a lot about on the news lately, the Thwaite and Pine Glacier. They're melting from below, I think, and that is driven by the warming ocean. But I guess, you know, most of the El Nino that Ilko was talking about, they have these powerful teleconnections that link the atmosphere and the ocean. So, you know, the heat's released and the atmosphere moves it around.
Are we studying at the moment what's happening with deep sea temperature? We must be.
We are, and I mean, in this building, National Oceanography Centre in Southampton is one of the leading institutions in the world for doing that. Certainly not something that me and Ilko are doing directly, but there are people down the corridor. You can go and fetch one if you like.
Yeah. Well, are things changing at the moment? Are people who are following this able to pick up changes in deep sea temperature yet?
Yeah, so the upper 700 meters of the oceans has taken up almost as much heat as global warming has given us over the last 100 years in the atmosphere. So if the ocean hadn't taken that heat up, then we would have had twice as much warming over the last century as that we actually see. And that's because the ocean has been helping us out. It's incidentally also been helping us out by taking up half of the CO2 that we've emitted. So it's really, the ocean is our biggest friend at the moment in this whole problem.
This must mean that, sorry to interrupt, Ilko, but this must mean that A, the top 700 meters of water is warmer, and B, a bit more acidic as well?
Yeah, true.
Yeah, I mean, the surface ocean's about half a degree warmer. Since pre-industrial times, I don't have the figure to hand for the rest of the ocean, but
yeah. So the half a degree is really the very surface. Yeah. I mean, if you go down to 700 meters, it's actually a very small signal because the signal is spread out over an enormous amount of heat capacity over 700 meters of ocean, and currently, as I said before, in areas where there's deep water formation, like in the North Atlantic. There is a signal that can be measured, but it is measured in sort of, you know, the fractions of a tenth of a degree, that signal of warming that is going down into the actual deep sea, down to 2 kilometers or more. So these signals are really small. They're very hard to measure. And in addition, of course, you got to get there first with the ship, and then you got to launch your probes down and measure your temperatures very, very accurately. Then you got to do that a number of times to make sure you're not just measuring some sort of anomaly, that you actually have a signal. And then you got to repeatedly do that. And bear in mind there that, you know, a day's ship time costs about $30,000.
I'm speaking to Dr. Gavin Foster from Southampton University's Department of Ocean and Earth Science, and Ilko Rolling, Professor of Ocean and Climate Change at the Australian National University. What's the time lag then? In terms of, well, I know I ask another question, which is, and this seems common sense to me, but the deeper the warming goes in the ocean, the stronger, the more momentum there is for warming of the entire Earth's environment. I'm not just talking about the atmosphere, I'm talking about everything. The deeper it goes, the longer the effect of whatever's happening right now will last.
Yeah,
that's right.
Absolutely.
And at the moment, there's still not a lot that we know about what's happening deep down and how long it will take to manifest itself back at the atmosphere, feeding back into the atmosphere.
Well, the only thing that we do know is that the system, over natural timescales of many centuries, the system is searching an equilibrium. So if we have an atmosphere that is steady at a certain temperature, a given climatic forcing that is steady over time, the atmosphere will find a certain temperature that is in equilibrium with the condition of the ocean. So if we increase the climate forcing, the atmosphere will warm up and the ocean will warm up much slower. But as that is warming, very slow warming is completed, and we can then reduce the climate forcing, the atmosphere will start to respond pretty quickly, but the ocean will then still give up a lot of heat as it is towards the atmosphere, as it is trying to also cool to a new equilibrium with the lower climate forcing. Now, these processes take hundreds of years, if not more than a millennium, but it is a continuous process of change. Now, the current climate forcing, the anthropogenic climate forcing, is very rapid and it's very large, and as a result, the atmosphere is responding measurably quick. The ocean is at the surface also responding measurably quick. The deep sea is only beginning to respond now after 200 years of forcing. Similarly slow are the ice sheets. They are only just beginning to respond to this warming because it takes time for the ice sheets to respond. There's a lot of heat capacity there.
I can imagine people wondering, well, if oceans can absorb a lot of the heat, how much can they potentially delay raises an increase in atmospheric temperatures because a lot of heat is going into the deeper ocean? In other words, might it buy us a bit more time than we thought, the ocean?
They already have been. The ocean has definitely been doing that already, because as I said, if the ocean hadn't warmed up, we would have been looking at about twice the amount of atmospheric warming. So if the planet was completely covered by land, which does not take up a lot of heat, then we would have had, instead of 0.8 degrees of global warming, we would be at 1.5.
And then this question, again, maybe you can't answer this yet, but when does the deep ocean begin to feed back into atmospheric temperatures? At the moment, it might be absorbing heat, but eventually, with currents, it will begin to feed back, won't it? When will that happen?
It will. For heat to come out of the deep ocean, it will take centuries. But for heat to come out of the upper 700 meters, that will start immediately to gradually warm up the atmosphere as soon as we start reducing the atmospheric climate forcing. So the upper 700 meters is well communicated with the atmosphere, but deeper than that, it takes centuries, both to warm it and to cool it.
So, I mean, the implications of that, of course, is even if we stop emitting CO2, the warming won't stop immediately, because the system then has to re-equilibrate with the forcing that we're then imposing, this reduced greenhouse gas forcing.
That's right. And at the same time, at some point, as I was saying then, even the deep ocean, let alone the 700 metres, the top 700 metres, will begin to feed back into the overall climate system. If it's been absorbing heat for a while and maybe slowing down the atmospheric change, it won't forever, will it?
No.
No.
But it will for a long time, right? Because our forcing at the moment is so far in the positive direction that the ocean is doing all it can to try and take up its fair share of the heat. So we would really have to drop probably the CO2 concentrations below 300 parts per million before the deep ocean really starts to think, oh, I need to re-equilibrate with a cooler world again, and that is going to then take hundreds of years.
Gavin Elko, it's been great talking to you. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Dr. Gavin Foster from Southampton University's Department of Ocean and Earth Science, and Elko Rowling, Professor of Ocean and Climate Change at the Australian National University, talking to me about their work studying the ancient history of deep ocean temperatures and the link between deep ocean temperatures and the overall climate system.